pharmaceuticals and personal care products that's sponsored by EPA's National Regional Science Council, PPPC's cross-regional team. My name is Jan Baxter, and I'm with EPA's Pacific Southwest region, which is also Region 9 in San Francisco, and I'll be monitoring and moderating today's session. We'll get started in just a few more moments. We're still getting some people beeping in for that, but while we wait for everyone to log on, I would like to cover a few of our housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, and it's sort of the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's sessions. We also have included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters whenever they were available. Please note that the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page in case you have any questions for one of them after today's presentation or if we are unable to get to your question. And for those of you who are joining us via phone lines, we request that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. We will have a question and answer session, and at that time you are welcome to take your phone off of mute and ask your question. If you do not have a mute button on your phone, we ask that you take a moment right now to hit *6 to place your phone on mute. When we get to the question and answer periods, you can hit #6 to unmute the phone. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. And please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to our seminar. And again, keep us on mute and don't put us on hold. By now, I'm hoping, based upon all of the little bings of people have been hearing, people are pretty much on the phone. So you should also have clicked on the agenda for today's go-to session icon and be on slide number 1 of the presentation if you're doing it by the web. The main page contains the slides, and above which you'll find navigation icons. You may submit questions by using the question mark icon, and you'll see that at the top of the slide. You do not need to wait, actually, until the question and answer period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit your questions in advance by using your computer. If you experience technical difficulties, and these happen sometimes, particularly with the audio stream, you can use that question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. But please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and that way we can try and help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the next slide, and you're the one that's going to have to do the advancing of the slides. You can advance to the next slide by using the single right arrow located above the slide, or alternatively, you can click on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. As stated earlier, we will have a question session after each of the two talks. Please note that there are additional resources, and you'll see an additional resource link on the main seminar page. We have placed relevant documents, links, and some other resources here for your information. This information will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We will be updating this page periodically, so please check back at a later date. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. And I think that's about a week's turnaround time. And associated with the links page is also an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We are discussing here in EPA whether or not to organize an additional PPCP webinar. And we would really appreciate your feedback on whether another webinar is needed, and if so, the most important topic areas. Also, we do look at the comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms of our webinar. So with that, I think we are ready to kick off this session. Today's first speaker is Mitch Kostich of EPA's Office of Research and Development. He will be speaking on prioritizing pharmaceuticals for study using bioinformatics approaches. Before I turn it over to Mitch, I would like to remind phone participants to put your phones on mute. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, please hit *6 now. And again, please remember, don't put us on hold. And thank you very much. I'll turn it over now to Mitch.
Thank you, Jan. The title of my talk today is An Informatic Approach to Estimating Ecological Risks Posed by Pharmaceutical Use. In particular, I'm going to be focusing on human prescription pharmaceuticals. Before I get started, I should just kind of read off a few caveats. First one is that although the presentation's been approved by EPA, it doesn't necessarily reflect EPA's official scientific position or any sort of policies. It's really, I'm just going to be telling you about the current state of my own personal research in ORD. And don't be surprised if you see another version of this talk in about a month or two that the numbers change somewhat. Given that, I'll tell you now we expect most of the numbers as they change to actually change downward. We think that 90% of the errors that we make when we're doing these projections actually overstate the risk of the problem, and that corrections that we make will tend to make the problem seem smaller than we do right now. Also, these are all rough estimates that are meant to guide measurements, actual chemical measurements of how much stuff is out there, and not replace those actual chemical measurements. And currently, even with this sort of estimation, we certainly don't have enough information to make any sort of thorough risk assessment for pharmaceuticals as a whole. Nevertheless, hopefully the talk will kind of narrow the scope of the problem in a lot of people's minds and be useful from that point of view. So I'm going to go to slide number 2. And this is an overview of the things I'm going to be talking about today. First off, I'm going to start telling you why we're interested in the problem in the first place and what needs we're trying to fulfill. Kind of our longer-term vision of how we're going to approach this problem, of which I'm only going to be talking about a small part today. That's the actual first part of our long-term plan, which is this model to project how much material is out there and how risky it might be. I'll show you some example data that's going to be coming out of the model, and tell you where we're going from here, and show you a few names of people who have helped contribute to the thinking behind the model. So I'm on slide number 3 right now. Part of our motivation, most of you should probably be familiar with a lot of these bullets. There's several thousand prescription products currently in use in the United States. A lot of them are excreted as either the parent compound, which is known to be active, or as metabolites, which are either thought or known to be active. And a lot of these active materials are found at part per trillion to part per billion levels in the environment. They've been found, you know, several of them have been found at those levels. And, you know, in a lot of cases, you might not worry about those levels of a contaminant in the environment, but most medications have been designed explicitly to be as potent as possible, both from the perspective of giving people smaller pills to take, which is a good thing, and also because of the thought that the smaller the dose you're giving, the smaller the chances of getting a side effect. And because they're so potent, we do have to kind of worry about these very low levels that people have seen in the environment. In addition to the low levels that have been measured in the environment, several of these chemicals have been found to have laboratory effects at concentrations that are similar to those that have been found in the environment. And the lab effects that we've seen are similar to troubling sorts of observations we've seen in natural populations out in the wild. Maybe the most prominent effect along these lines is feminization of fish and interference with the reproduction of fish. Beyond that, since we see these problems at levels that we see in the environment, we're also concerned about what happens to people who might be swimming in the rivers or eating the fish or drinking water from water supplies that are derived from that water that the fish are swimming in. So moving on to slide 4, just to kind of give you an overview of what we know, there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge right now, a lot of gaps we need to fill before we can make any sort of realistic risk assessment. The occurrence and the effects data that we have for these compounds is still way too limited. And the bottom line criteria for saying that it's too limited is that we can't reliably identify the risks or quantify the risks, tell you which things we need to be worried about or how worried we need to be about them. And until we can do that, we really have a data gap. The problem's been out there for years, well over a decade, depending on how you count the problem, but the first time that the first pharmaceutical was brought up as a potential contaminant was a long time ago. And the fact that we don't know so much about it really reflects the scope of the problem. You know, we talk about pharmaceuticals as a single class of substances, but they're really not. They vary a lot in both their chemical and biological properties. It's not like when we talk about PCBs or when we talk about heavy metals, which to a large degree share modes of toxic action as well as their physical properties. So we really, with these things, you're really looking at a grab bag of things that have been kind of put in a grab bag based on kind of unusual criteria. In addition, the toxicity and potency of most of these compounds in non-humans isn't known. So particularly when we start talking about what effects these might have on fish and that sort of thing, that's really where we're talking about the great unknown. But we do know that sensitivities to a lot of these drugs can vary by many-fold across species, and so there's some reason to be concerned. So when we start to look at what's out there, one of the problems is that a lot of things have been looked at, but it's only really a small subset of the potential things to look for. There's thousands of drugs out there being used right now, and in addition to the drugs that are out there, we have to worry about their metabolites. We have to worry about byproducts when those metabolites or the parent compounds react with chlorine or oxygen or a variety of other things, all the different degradative products that get formed. And there's, in the end, you're dealing with realistically tens of thousands of potential analytes, and to really analyze all those is slow, difficult, and very expensive with current technology. It's essentially undoable. Somehow we have to narrow down the list to a doable subset. Even if we knew which ones to look for, we don't really, the kind of occurrence data that we have right now, it doesn't always look in the same place, and that's a good thing in some ways, but it also creates some problems. I mean, there's a lot of different places that you could potentially look, places like wastewater treatment plant influence and effluents, the sludge coming out of those places, the surface water, the groundwater, the sediments, runoff from agricultural fields that have land-applied biosolids on them, tissues from different critters from here and there. All, there's good, solid reasons for measuring concentrations in each one of those places. But as a result, people have kind of gone into a lot of different places and made measurements, and so we don't really have a huge body of analytical data in any one particular medium, and that kind of hurts us a little bit, too. Now, moving to the next slide, is slide 5. One other issue, even if you didn't, we went out and we took a few measurements of how high the concentration of something is. Another thing, we need a good number of measurements, because we have to somehow characterize how much do the concentrations vary from location to location. We have a lot of reasons to think that the concentrations do vary because there's a lot of contributory factors such as demographics and treatment technologies and the hydrology of the location plus the seasonality factors and things like that, all of which will affect how much material is coming out the back end of a wastewater treatment plant, for instance. Okay. And the thing that we have to answer for is how well can one set of readings help us predict what's going on in a different location? How well do readings, for instance, in Duluth help us predict what might be going on down in Las Vegas? I mean, the areas are so different, we don't really know that right now. And that's something that needs to be characterized at some point. Beyond that, even if we knew which chemicals to look for and what the concentrations were in different locations, it's kind of hard, given the current data set, to know what those concentrations mean in terms of effects. And a lot of that is due to the fact that a lot of the effects testing that's been done to date has been done using kind of older testing paradigms where we're looking for dead fish, fish that are floating dead up. We're not really looking for subtle effects on reproduction or behavior. And we're looking at typically assays where, to keep the cost down and to kind of do it the same way we do it for other chemicals, the exposure durations are relatively short, probably in the order of days instead of the months or years that it takes to show some of the chronic effects. And the other thing is that in order to get some of these effects, like killing fish in, a couple-day assay or something like that, often the concentrations end up getting pumped up in these assays to levels that are just not environmentally relevant. So it's very hard to extrapolate a large body of the effects data over to what are going to turn out to be environmentally relevant concentrations. So that's a lot of stuff we don't know, but what do we know? Why are we still concerned? Is it just because we don't know stuff? Well, there is some positive evidence that there's some reason for concern. Two interesting anecdotal cases that I'll talk about here real quickly are for instance, ethinyl estradiol, which is a component of birth control pills, and its effects on fish reproduction. And again, that's probably the best known poster child for the effects of pharmaceuticals in the environment. And another case is the effect of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRI, on amphibian metamorphosis, where you can see that frogs, for instance, can enter a metamorphosis, go through metamorphosis improperly and have problems with limb development and things like that. And with both of these things, those are both effects that you can see with chronic low-level exposure, similar to the levels that you expect to see in the environment. So that's a little bit of a concern. Another thing we see from these anecdotal cases is that the toxicity is related to the therapeutic mechanism of action. For the case of ethinyl estradiol, it's no big surprise that it would affect fish reproduction because that's what the thing's designed to do, is affect reproduction. And in the case of the toxicity we see in amphibians from SSRIs, it can be rationalized based on what we know between serotonin signaling in the brain and what we know about thyroid signaling. Okay? And we know that those two pathways are connected in all vertebrates. but it seems that there's a particular point of a particular developmental window of vulnerability that makes this effect pop up at a particular point in development in frogs. So in any case, what we see is what we're going to try to focus on is those kind of cases that follow those examples, where it looks like the sort of toxicity we see is chronic, is a response to chronic low-level exposure, and where the toxicity looks pretty much, it's related to the sort of effects you expect to see in humans from administering these drugs. So I'm going to move to slide 6, more kind of unmet research needs. So these are kind of, right now, several groups are gathering occurrence data around the world, measuring the presence of different substances. But, you know, the chemicals that they pick to measure, it's often a little bit haphazard. They're usually pretty good choices, but they're not necessarily all-inclusive of all the chemicals that you want to look at and that sort of thing. So what we're worried about are we really looking for the right things, the things that are likely to be the largest threat? And when we look in those areas, are we looking at the right molecules? Sometimes it's the parent compound, not what we should be interested in. It's actually an active metabolite that's going to pose the greatest risk. So once we start to collect the occurrence data and we start to measure these things, then we also need to fill in the gap of, well, what does that occurrence data mean? What's the likelihood of toxicity occurring as a result of that occurrence? And what's the who or what is likely to be affected by those concentrations? And also, what form is the toxicity likely to take? So these are all things we'd like to kind of feed into. These are all big gaps right now, and we'd like to help inform those gaps. In addition to that, what we're doing is, by building up this model, it's kind of a sort-to-think mechanistic model of how the stuff gets into the environment in the first place. And so that, from a scientific point of view, helps us understand what's going on. And from a practical point of view, also helps us if we decide that we need to intervene somewhere and reduce the exposure to something, kind of gives you some idea of where different, what sort of difference a proposed mitigation strategy might make. So the next slide, slide 7. This is kind of the big picture of the plan, and it kind of breaks down into three pieces. The first part is is what I'm going to be talking about mostly today, which is using the available data that's out there already to rank the most likely threats, figure out what the things that are most urgently need of study. Okay, and once we figure out those things, then we go to the second stage, which is to actually measure the concentrations for as many of those things as possible, because we know our model is much less than 100%, right? And we need to correct the numbers and also feedback into the model to make the model better, and also to reprioritize things for chronic toxicity testing. So eventually we get down to the point of a few things that we'd be concerned about that we'd need to do chronic toxicity testing in whatever organism we thought would be vulnerable to the drug. Okay. And I'm not going to go into too much detail on all the bullets here, but I'm going to actually jump to the next slide, slide 8. And it gives you a kind of a graphic picture of that, where what we're doing, our process is kind of thing, we think of it kind of as a funnel, where you can feed a whole bunch of things in at the top. It turns out to be close to 400 chemicals we can look at the top, and actually project their environmental concentrations, and then normalize those based on what we think, what concentrations we don't think, you know, normalize them based on potency. So the things that so we're going to normalize those based on potency.
Thank you very much.
So once you get down,
okay, someone needs to mute.
Someone needs to mute their phone.
So once we've used predicted environmental concentrations to prioritize things, that prioritizes them to look at a smaller subset. We're going to probably go down from about 400 to about 50 things that we actually want to look at the concentrations of in the environment, and that's that second layer in the funnel. And once we do that, well, for humans, like I'm going to talk about in a little bit, we can really jump to the bottom of the funnel and already start to do some first-order risk assessments for humans. For wildlife, there's a couple more layers in the funnel we have to worry about. The F and T, what happens, really, what I'm talking about there is metabolism. We have to look at how this stuff gets metabolized in fish, how they handle stuff. And then finally, for things that don't look like they're metabolized very well, we need to look at toxicity. Again, we know the parameters for metabolism and toxicity in humans, so we don't need to do that so much. In any case, the main point of the funnel is to show that it's all kind of hooked in together, and then we can look at a whole bunch of things rather cheaply at the top, and as we get down to the bottom of the funnel, we're going to be looking at a handful of things using fairly expensive assays. So moving on to slide 9, the model can't give us a definitive answer, and so what we try to do is bias it in a certain way so we can still get some useful information out. The problem with the model is there's too many uncertainties in the underlying data that we use to generate the model, and it creates too broad an error bar to say anything too definitive. Like I mentioned, that's okay for the most part because we're using the model to guide measurements that'll kind of narrow down those error bars And we're certainly not trying to replace any sort of measurements by doing the modeling. We try to skew our errors so that towards kind of a worst case scenario as much as possible. The reason we do that is because otherwise, if we didn't do this, we probably wouldn't be able to do this kind of project at all. The data is not accurate enough. So what we do is we have all these data gaps we have to deal with, and what we do is we fill them with worst case dummy values. And I'll talk to you a little bit more about the model and where those data gaps are in a second. But just keep in mind, wherever we have data gaps, we pretty much try to figure out put a worst case dummy value in. And as a result, we kind of end up rephrasing the question as instead of saying that the likelihood of an effect is exactly X, what we try to say is that the likelihood of an effect is no worse than okay? So the likelihood of having some sort of biological effect from this concentration of stuff is no worse than X. Okay? And for some drugs, X is worrisome. And as I'll show you in a little bit, that number of drugs is actually kind of on the small side when you look at the number we started with. And and for some of those, the worrisome numbers are because of the skew that we have and this biases that we have in doing the modeling. But we think that's okay because once we get around to actually measuring environmental concentrations, that'll kind of take care of itself. We'll correct those numbers. On the other hand, for a lot of these, a lot of the chemicals that we looked at originally, even the worst case numbers don't look all that bad. And it kind of makes us say, well, without some additional lines of evidence, we don't think we should even kind of bother to measure these in a lot of cases, especially if we have some other corroboratory points for the model. So what we're trying to do is by, saying, well, maybe, a handful of things look like they still could be dangerous under worst case scenario, but even under worst case scenario, a whole bunch of things don't look all that worrisome. I'll talk about that a little more in a second. But there's always a concern here. It's always conceivable that what we think is the worst case isn't really the worst case, and that there's some kind of funny, unanticipated processes that are operating that make the worst case worse than we anticipated. So that's always the caveat that has to be kept in mind. So to go on to slide 10, just to kind of go over the model a little bit. So what we do is first, where's the stuff coming from? Well, for this point in the model, it's rather simplistic. We're only looking at human prescriptions from 2004, because that's the data that we had when we started the project. We don't include over-the-counter medications. We don't include byproducts from manufacturing, none of the gray market imports, none of the pet medications, nothing that's used in agriculture or anything else. Okay? And we have two sets of data, and they're both imperfect. One is we have data based on how many dollars worth of medication gets sold each year, and the other set of data is how many prescriptions get written each year. And unfortunately, neither one of these can you directly read over and figure out exactly what the quantity of medication that was distributed was. But what you can do is you can kind of figure out a worst-case scenario for each one of those and end up with kind of what amounts to two overestimates, one overestimate based on the dollar value sold and one overestimate based on the scripts written. And what we do in our models, we just take the lower of these two overestimates. Okay? And so it's still kind of a worst-case estimate, but it's a little lower than the higher of the two estimates we might have here. We move on to slide 11. So that kind of gets us to how much of the stuff gets dispensed every year in the United States. And then, so how does it get into the environment? And we figure there's two routes into the environment. One is through stuff that gets wasted, either by getting flushed down the toilet or something like that, or thrown in the trash can, or getting washed off the human body, especially for topical medications and things like shampoos and things like that. You have to worry about that. And here's some numbers that we use, and these are kind of fudge factors. Nobody really knows the right numbers to use here for how much medication actually gets wasted or washed off. But after talking to a bunch of people, these seem like fairly reasonable numbers that would at least would convey the idea that there's other routes into the environment other than through the human body. For the rest of the material, though, we assume it goes through the human body. And for the top 65 or so medications on the list, what we did is we actually went through and looked at how much of the material, what we know about the metabolism of the stuff in the human body, how much of the material actually gets inactivated as it passes through the human body. In a lot of cases, virtually all the material does get inactivated, and we wanted to take account of that. Whereas in other cases, we know that most of the material comes out intact, either as the parent compound or as a very active metabolite. What the model doesn't take into account, so really what we're doing here is at that point we take the total amount of material that's coming through the human body or getting disposed of, and we divide it through by the total amount of wastewater produced in the United States every year. Okay, and that's an EPA figure we had from a few years back. And from that we calculate basically what amounts to an influent concentration. Okay, But what we're missing here is we're missing a bunch of processes that'll take place from the time it, you know, hits the toilet to, you know, compounds will break down on the way to the wastewater treatment plant. We don't take account of that. Inside the wastewater treatment plant, stuff can break down there. Once it leaves the wastewater treatment plant, it can get fertilized by light. Oxygen can break down. All kinds of things can happen. It can get partitioned out of the aqueous phase. A lot of things can happen that we don't take account of. It can get diluted a lot by rainwater and things like that. We don't take account of any of that. But one thing to keep in mind is that all those processes will tend to lower the aqueous concentration. None of them will tend to raise it. Okay? So our general approach of trying to use a worst case approach to this whole problem is pretty much intact. It's not going to really be affected by the fact that we're not considering those things. On the other hand, because we don't consider those things, some of our numbers are absurdly high, and they're way higher than the actual measured concentration. And that probably largely accounts for why that is. On the next slide, slide 12, another thing to keep in mind is when we express numbers on here, they'll often not only reflect the concentration of a single molecule. So in other words, we might talk about a particular drug like ibuprofen and it making its way out into the environment. And you will typically report one number, so many parts per trillion or parts per billion being out there. But really what we're doing, since we're trying to do a risk estimate here, is we're often summing not only over the current compound, but we have to sum the numbers over all the metabolites that might contribute to the activity that's getting dumped into the environment. And I'm not really going to go into all the details, although most of them in the bills of the slide for those of you who might care about this. But the bottom line is that we're reporting one number that's actually an aggregate number that's kind of expressing how much activity is out there due to both the parent and any metabolites. Okay, and slide 13. A little bit of how we talk about toxicity and how we estimate toxicity for these drugs. From the point of human toxicity, pharmaceuticals are an unusually well-studied class of pollutants. The human physiology is really extensively studied, both as short-term exposure and chronic exposure, and that's true for a variety of other mammalian species, typically rats, sometimes mice, sometimes dogs, sometimes guinea pigs. And a variety of mammalian species, we have a lot of information on these things about. We know about the absorption, the metabolism, the excretion, the relationship between the blood levels and what effects to expect when you reach those kind of blood levels, what sort of chronic toxicity expect and other side effects you might encounter, the developmental effects and whether they're safe during pregnancy or not. Often we know exactly what the molecular pathway is that's affected and how it results in the effect. And we also know how the human body or mammalian bodies in general generally get rid of these things. So this is a lot to know and a lot more than you would typically know for a relatively novel class of pollutants. So for humans, if you really want to make some kind of risk estimates for humans, the main thing that the main unknown is the rate of exposure. We don't know how much humans are intaking on a daily basis. Okay, and if we did know that, because we have so much information on actually effects data in humans, we probably could come up with a fairly reasonable risk estimate. So typically, what we're shooting at is coming up with some way to express the exposure in humans, and usually the way that it's exposed by not only us but several other groups is how many days of exposure would it take to reconstitute a single human dose. Okay? Because people understand if every 2 hours you're absorbing a dose, you know, that means one thing, and if it takes you 5 years to absorb a dose, in most people's minds, that kind of, you know, it's a clearly different situation with a clearly different level of worry associated with it. So it's a kind of intuitively interpretable quantity, and as well as being a fairly reasonable quantity to use for scientific risk assessment. For non-humans, we have a much more cloudy situation. We know that toxin sensitivities and pharmaceutical sensitivities in particular can differ dramatically across species. Although they tend to be pretty close in mammals, typically 10 to 100-fold at most differences in sensitivity to different drugs, they can be much, much larger when you start crossing across phylogenetic classes. So, for instance, going from mammals to fish or mammals to reptiles or mammals to birds or further than that, really a lot of those we really don't know what fold protection factor we need to include when we're doing this kind of thing or anything like that. We really don't know. They might be as large as like 10,000 in some cases. There's some data for some toxins showing that the sensitivities can differ by 10,000-fold. That's really a very large range. So to try to get at the non-human toxicity, which again, you know, that's a little tougher one to pin down, we make some assumptions. And again, a lot of these assumptions are motivated by those anecdotal cases that I was talking about earlier, where we talk about like ethanol estradiol and fish reproduction, or SSRIs and amphibian metamorphosis. We assume that the mechanism of a toxicity that you're going to see in non-human organisms is related to the human therapeutic mechanism of action. Okay? So if the drug normally in humans causes a drop in blood pressure and you know, affects the pathways involved in blood pressure regulation, then it'll affect similar pathways in a fish, for instance. Okay? And same thing with reproductive medicines and what have you. Okay? Similarly, we assume that human potency is related to potency in non-humans. So if you have, for instance, a birth control agent, or an estrogen, for instance, that's 100-fold as potent in humans as another one, we assume that there'll be dramatic potency difference in non-humans as well. And this is, again, is this always the case? Do we know that this is always going to be the case? Not really, because the evidence is so sparse that we don't really know for sure. But it is pretty consistent with the scan evidence that we do have. So what we try to do is that based on those assumptions, we try to use what's known about the molecular pathways, particularly in humans, to guide toxicity testing, both in terms of what organisms are going to be affected, based on the phylogenetic distribution of the pathway, as well as the form that the toxicity will take, whether it's expected to be reproductive toxicity, behavioral, or what have you. Okay? For non-humans, our worst case, I mentioned that the sensitivities can differ very dramatically between humans and non-humans, and the way we try to get at this, we came up with another measure that we're still playing with. It seems like a pretty reasonable one. We don't know for sure. We won't know for a while whether it's appropriate. But we know that in many cases where we know that there's dramatic differences in sensitivities to a drug between humans and a non-human, it's due to an extended half-life. In other words, the non-human can't get rid of the drug as effectively as humans can, so the drug builds up in the non-human to the point that it becomes toxic. Okay? So it seems like in many, many cases, the differences in sensitivity are due to differences in ability to get rid of bad stuff. Okay? And so the worst case here would be an organism that can't get rid of the bad stuff at all. Now, we figure in that case, if you can't get rid of the bad stuff at all, there's typically, you're not going to have, I mean, we might be proved wrong on this, but from what we know, you're not going to typically have a way of concentrating the material either. It would be odd for you to have a mechanism to concentrate a particular class of molecules without also having a set of mechanisms to detoxify that same class of molecules. They tend to kind of co-occur. We'll see whether that's always true, but that seems pretty reasonable for now. And so, if you can't clear anything and you can't concentrate anything and you just sit in a soup of something, after a while you're going to equilibrate with your environment. The concentration inside your bloodstream is going to become the same as the concentration floating around in the water you're swimming around in, okay? And at that point we assume that we can start to estimate what the significance of having a plasma concentration that's that high if we assume that what's called intrinsic potency, so the potency once the stuff is in your blood, is similar between humans and non-humans. Is this always going to be the case? No. But typically, most of these drugs have been developed, have been optimized in mammals, and they're typically going to interact pretty effectively with the mammalian proteins that they're designed to interact with. And if you throw them at a fish or a bug protein or something like that, there's some chance it'll interact with greater potency, but it's pretty unlikely. In general, you're going to see the potencies at that, the intrinsic potency are actually typically going to be lower. Okay? So in any case, those are kind of our assumptions that go in and how we construct a worst-case scenario for non-humans. We look at them just kind of equilibrating with their environment and then ask how close are those blood concentrations that we predict would happen in those non-humans to what we know is an effective concentration in humans, concentration in the blood that would have an effect. If we go to slide 15, here's kind of a schematic of how our process works. We start off in the upper left-hand corner with sales data for about 900 products. And that accounts for some 400 different active ingredients. And then we have two different schemes for figuring out how much gets dispensed every year. One is based on the dollars of material that gets sold every year. And that's the data that I'm going to show you today. Okay? And the other scheme is based on the number of scripts that get written each year. And that's not complete. Well, it's kind of complete, but I don't have it all integrated into the slides for this talk. So all the data I'm showing you does not reflect the scripts written data right now. But that's basically how the process is going to work, and that should all be finalized in a couple of weeks here. And what we do is we take those two estimates, and we take the lesser of the two, and we come up with a short list of drugs that we look at in more detail. And we take that short list of drugs, and we look at the excreted activity, what percentage of the drug gets excreted in active form, once it passes through the human body. And we take a look at that, and based on those numbers, we multiply them all through, and we end up with a projected environmental concentration, or PEC, okay? And that PEC, we need to account for the fact that some drugs, have very high dosages, they're not very potent, you have to take a horse pill to have an effect, whereas other drugs are super potent, you take tiny, tiny pills and they have huge effects. And so we need to somehow normalize for that potency, to take account of potency. And so we do that at this case, and so we take the PEC and we divide it by the minimum daily dose in humans. and we come up with a number that says how many liters of wastewater treatment plant influent would you have to drink in order to reconstitute a single dose of the drug. And we use that number to prioritize all the drugs for further study. So in slide 16, I'm going to show you some of the data. Just to remind you, they're based on the dollar sales data. We're going to have to include script written data shortly, and that's going to narrow the uncertainties a bit, bring down the numbers a little bit. And we tend to dramatically overestimate in some cases, and I list some of the reasons for why that happens here. Basically, the more drugs there are that contain the active ingredient, and typically the higher the estimates become, sometimes out of control, because we start throwing in a lot of fudge factors on top of fudge factors on top of fudge factors. And one drug that you'll see pop up in the list further on down is hydrochlorothiazide, and we think that's really a nice example of where this overestimation ends up taking place. Another thing is that, well, we try to do worst case here, but you got to remember we're only looking at prescription drug use here, so we're actually underestimating some classes, and particularly some of the drugs that are indicated with an asterisk in the following tables. They have over-the-counter contributions, which typically are larger than the prescription contributions, and they're not accounted for here. Okay. And the list also doesn't include a number of things that are done by prescription, a number of vitamins, prenatal vitamins, things like that, minerals, electrolytes, x-ray contrast media, which we threw out and didn't include in the analysis for a variety of reasons. Slide 17 gives you a quick example, and all I'm trying to do is show you in this example is kind of the range of how much stuff gets dispensed every year. Okay, and if you look at the top of the slide, you can see that you're talking about, you know, thousands of tons of material. Okay, and if you go down to the bottom of the slide, you're talking about a couple ounces of material. Okay, so this is the range of the amounts of material that get dumped out from the top 400 or so drugs. And if you look at the right-hand column, that's the daily doses. You'll see that things that are usually get administered in huge, huge amounts, part of the reason is because the dosage that's needed to have an effect is actually quite large. Whereas, in part, some of the drugs that you don't see a lot being administered, part of the reason is not only because they're not that popular, but also because the doses can be very small. So you really have to take potency into account in order to interpret what's going on. On the next slide, slide 18, I show you a bunch of active ingredients here. And these are actually, if you look at the rightmost column, those are the liters. How many liters of wastewater treatment plant influent you'd have to drink in order to reconstitute a single dose? And you can see hydrochlorothiazide, that's the one I mentioned, that actually we know the numbers are skewed upward very badly. But even for that one, you'd have to drink on the order of about 40 liters in order to reconstitute a single dose. And you can see, and you can see after that, after hydrochlorothiazide, as you work down the list, you're quickly into the many hundreds of liters you'd have to drink in order to reconstitute a dose, and then the thousands of liters of influent that you'd have to drink in order to reconstitute a dose. And keep in mind that these are all under worst-case assumptions. Most of these are actually understating how much you'd have to drink because they're overstating the concentration. So you can get a general sense for human use that you're going to have to be drinking for a long time in order to get a single dose of any of these compounds. Slide 19. Here we're trying to look at that other case. Well, what about the fish? You know, how much do we have to worry about fish? Well, here the situation's not so clear. If we use our worst case scenario where we're saying, gosh, what if it's this fish that just has no idea how to deal with this stuff and just equilibrates with this environment? It just ends up that the internal concentration equals what's going on outside. We can see that ratio in the next to last column, which is the PEC high over the Cmax, that's actually the predicted environmental concentration divided by the kind of concentration that we know causes an effect in humans when the plasma concentration is that high. And you can see that a bunch of them are over 1. Okay, so they potentially, the interpretation of this, potentially they could have an effect on this kind of organism, an organism that couldn't get rid of this stuff. Okay, and there's quite a few. But again, you can see that it's quickly getting down towards 1, and that out of the, 400 or so active ingredients we looked at, the number's below 1 for the vast majority of them. On the next slide, I'm almost done here, just going to show you quickly that another thing that needs to be taken account of is that a lot of drugs actually share a mechanism of action. They'll act through the same pathway, and presumably they'll act more or less additively along those pathways. So you have to somehow add the activities across several drugs. And just to show you that there's many classes that have multiple members, I show that in slide 20 here, and you can see in slide 21 some of the smaller groups. But they don't all necessarily share groups. In slide 22, you can see that of drugs that ended up in the top 65, a lot of them have unique mechanisms of action, at least within that top 65. And slide 23 gives you an example of how we look at, try to figure out, you know, what range of species might be sensitive to the drugs and stuff like that. And this is some older data, but it just kind of shows you how we go about looking at this. On the left-hand column, we have the active ingredient. And the second column over, that's the pregnancy category. And what we're trying to get at here is whether there's any evidence in mammals of there being particular points in development that are unusually sensitive to the drug. And the way we read this, typically, it's a pregnancy category of A, means by all means, use it in pregnancy. B is use it kind of cautiously. We don't have enough data, maybe, or there's slight evidence of some, maybe some kind of hard. C means only use it if it absolutely is required for the health of the mom. And X means don't use it. It's really, you know, it's really counterindicated in pregnancy. Okay. And you notice some things that are relatively safe in adults, like the statins, atorvastatin and simvastatin, are actually prohibited in pregnant women. And you know, so that's something to kind of keep in mind. You might actually look for developmental effects with those kind of drugs. And the next column over, the target, that's actually the shorthand nomenclature for the protein target of these things. So how the drug acts at a molecular level inside humans, okay? And then we look at how those molecular targets are conserved across a variety of critters, from mammals to birds to frogs to fish to arthropods to nematodes to plants to fungi in this case. And we actually have it broken all down into a lot more detail, but that's too big a slide, too big a data set to turn into a slide readily. But generally, you can get a feel, for instance, that the statins, atorvastatin, actually its target is actually distributed all the way through fungi. The fungi have the target of atorvastatin. Whereas if you talked about something like levothyroxine, the second entry, it's a thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormones are only known in vertebrates, and they're not really anticipated to affect anything other than vertebrates unless you ramp the concentration up to a pretty ridiculous level. Okay? Just as an example of how we're using this kind of information. On the next slide, these are the major uncertainties with our data. This is slide 24. The biggest problem is marketing data. We don't have enough of it, and it's not good enough, the stuff that we have. We wish we could do better. We also don't have enough information on chemical stability once it gets flushed down the toilet or whatever. And like I mentioned before, we have a lot of gaps in our knowledge about effects in non-mammals. We also don't know much about the spatial and temporal variability in the concentrations we'll see out in the environment. And our model here, well, you know, it's altogether missing information on sources from over-the-counter use, agriculture, manufacturing, pets, natural excretion, things like that. Some of that we can compensate for and is in the works. Others are just big data gaps we don't know how to deal with at this point. On slide 25, where are we going from here? We're going to try to improve the model based on some of the things that I mentioned in some of the bullets in here. Maybe the most prominent ones are we're trying to take up a look at biomagnification. That would be a big one we're real interested in looking at because that can upset our worst case estimate. And also to look at, in some cases, we do know about active uptake systems, which we're assuming don't exist, but sometimes we know they do, and we'd like to include those in the model. And, of course, we'd like to improve our data all around. On slide 26, all around, we're trying to, in the big picture, we're going to go out and try to figure out what to measure and start measuring them actually out there, try to get an idea of what the actual occurrences are, and then try to go out and figure out where exactly it's coming from, and look at things like internal dose in non-human organisms, and start doing chronic toxicity testing and stuff. And then slide 27, acknowledgments. This is slide's probably too short. A lot of people have dropped me little notes and given me little ideas on how to think about this, and it's all been very helpful. But these are the people who've kind of consistently helped out with this project every time. And that's it for my talk. What I'm going to do now is turn you over to Jan Baxter for the Q&A session.
Hi. Thank you very much, Mitch. I'd now like to open our question and answer session. And with both simulcast and telephone audiences, I'm going to switch back and forth between the groups so everybody has an opportunity to have their questions answered. Also, please feel free to provide us comments that give the audience further contacts or information on this topic. We will share as many of these resource comments as possible, but if all the time is filled with questions from the speakers, then we'll go ahead and post as much of the resource information as we can on the additional resource webpage. And I'd also like to remind everyone that if you aren't able to get your questions answered now, don't hesitate to email our speakers. You'll find the speaker's email address on the main webinar page. And with that, I'd like to start with a question from our web audience. And the first one's from Charlotte Smith. Have you taken into consideration patient noncompliance of between 5% and 40%, that's an estimate, and the fact that many of these will be drain disposed without being metabolized?
What we try to do, and again, we're not sure of the right numbers. Is it 5 or 40? And I don't think anyone really does. But we assume that, maybe this is right or wrong, but we assume that people, if they're taking a medication on a recurring basis, something like a blood pressure medication or a statin, they got to take it every day, they're less likely to waste it than if they take that, get that 2-week course of antibiotic therapy, and then after a week they feel better and they throw the rest of the bottle in the, you know, or same thing with pain medications, they're no longer in pain, they throw the pain medication bottle over. Either away or into a cupboard for a long time. And so what we estimate is that, well, typically for things that are administered on an acute short-term basis, there's probably more waste, and we use the number 15% for that. And for chronically administered medication, we know some of that gets wasted, but we think the number's lower, and we're guessing that the number's around 5%. In addition to that, what we do is we assume that topical medications, you often end up with some stuff left in the tube, and you end up smearing it all over your body, and a lot gets washed off, and metabolism never gets, has a chance to take place. And we assume up to 33% of that gets washed off and goes that route. Some of the numbers might be a little too low, but they're probably not dramatically too low. And in any case, for those drugs that we know get completely metabolized, at least it accounts for stuff that never passes through the human body and never even has a chance to metabolize. So we'll at least see some of it being predicted to go enter the environment.
Okay. Can we go ahead and perhaps have someone from our phone audience ask a question? Okay. We've got another one from the web. This is from Aiken Abitola of City of Santa Cruz in California here. It says, great summation, thanks. I noticed the absence of bacterial targets in slide 23. Using E. coli and Salmonella molecular targets, it appears that there is cause for concern with bacteria. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The reason they don't show up on that slide is just because I only went down in fungi in this one, and I don't go into prokaryotes. Actually, in our full analysis, we break everything down into 34 taxon bins that covers the whole tree of life, even viruses and things like that, wherever the targets might map there. In terms of the effects, you know, we're probably going to be looking for a different sort of endpoint there. We're probably not going to be thinking about bad things happening to the fish per se, although maybe something will happen bad to the gut, to the bacteria in their guts. But one of the areas that we are looking at is parasite, you know, seeing potential effects on parasite and then trying to tie in the relationships between bacterial targets and microbiota that are actually living in the streams, and we're kind of interested in those kind of effects. So yeah, we are keeping our eye on that one. It's another aspect of the problem. It's a, certainly one of concern.
Okay, anybody on the phone that has a question now?
Yes, this is Region 8. My question, Barbara Benoit, my question is there any way to compensate from the lack of source data from agriculture? Because to me, that's huge, and it could even be, in some cases, for some pharmaceuticals, could be even greater contribution.
Yeah, I think for some drugs, like I think oxytetracycline is a good example. I mean, it's almost certain there's a lot more of it used in agriculture and aquaculture than it's used in humans. I think that has to be taken account of. Fortunately, I think it's only going to perturb the numbers for a subset of drugs. I think for a lot of the really big brand name players in human pharmacology, things like the statins, the beta blockers, antidepressants, the use outside of humans is pretty limited. Maybe in like, although I don't know, there's some you know anecdotal things where a particular drug is used. But I think it's going to be a pretty small subset of drugs that are used widely outside of humans. Although if you start talking pets, boy, they prescribe just about everything for pets these days. But we'd like to get a better grip on it. If we can find a solid data source, we'd love to include it. But right now, it's very hard to model.
Okay, the next question is from our web, and it's that they would be interested in the speaker's perspective on a recent risk assessment performed by Schwab et al. It's 2005, which employs a similar model, HHRA, using therapeutic point of departure values to estimate PNEC, and that's Taj Ijaz, Paul Ijaz. Okay?
I have a feeling I've seen it, but I don't remember the details of the study, so I can't answer that question. But what I'll try to do is I'll go look it up and cook up a response and get it back, and hopefully we can post it on the website.
Great. Anyone else on the phone that would like a question?
I've got one. It's Tony Tripp with the Florida DEP. I was wondering how long you estimate before you have some analytical data to correlate with your model.
It's hard to say. I'm gonna say we probably should start. We're in the process. We're setting up the analytical equipment and getting data and getting standards together. I imagine we should probably start taking readings inside of 6 to 9 months. But when we'll actually have something ready for prime time to present, I'm gonna guess it's gonna probably be a year and a half or so.
Okay.
And it'll probably be an ongoing study that takes a long time after that to really wrap up.
Oh yeah.
Okay, the next one's from our web audience, and it's, have you considered antibiotics being dumped down the drain and their effect on the biological treatment at the wastewater treatment plant?
We thought about it. I have this kind of gut feeling. I'm not sure how, it's not empirical or anything, that most of those bugs that actually are responsible for breaking down stuff and activated sludge treatment and things like that, that they're probably going to get resistant to the stuff pretty quickly and overcome the relatively low concentrations. I think mostly when we think about it, again, we're probably thinking more about effects on the microbiota living on the rocks downstream, that they might be slower growing, slower multiplying, and not have as many opportunities to gain resistance, and that's actually where you might see bad things happening. And same thing with when we think about antibiotic resistance, we're actually more concerned that, boy, you're breeding all kinds of antibiotic-resistant bugs in your guts when you're taking the antibiotics, and what happens to the wastewater treatment plant is probably of secondary importance.
Okay, time for the phone. Anyone on the phone with a question? Okay, another question from the web then. Is there any way to consider the contributions from illegal drugs since so many of them are used?
Well, there was that very, the paper that got a lot of attention on the Po River in Italy, where people tried to kind of backtrack from environmental concentrations to try to figure out what the incidence of drug use is. But, if you look at those studies, it's kind of tough because it's the same problems I have. You end up having to make a lot of assumptions. And when you start making that many assumptions, well, you can probably discriminate 10 or 100-fold differences. But doing two-fold differences, it's probably not so clear, and your error bars are too big to make those kind of determinations. So you might actually have better ways of estimating that, although I'm not going to say it's not worth a try. But that's not where we're going.
Okay. Just a comment that came through that people might be interested in is the Schwab paper that was mentioned as a question is amongst the additional resources we had it contributed from Thomas White of Pharma, just so you'll know.
Thanks.
Uh-huh. Then I think anybody on the phone? Then we'll go to the next question. I think this will have to be our last question, and I apologize if anybody hasn't gotten their question answered. We'll try to get those later done, maybe in the additional resources part. The last question is, follow-up to the interest in bacteria is based on the emerging problem of antibiotic resistance and plasmid exchange among bacteria, leading to virulence in otherwise non-virulent bacteria. Is that the case?
I'm not really sure where it's going to fit in. We know that when you're taking antibiotics, you're probably breeding a lot of antibiotic-resistant bugs in your own body. Whether the levels that are actually in the water are high enough to get the bugs to become resistant, get virulent bugs resistant to what's going on in the water, I'm not sure. Plasma transferring resistance that way, again, I'm not really sure. I think there's a lot of unknowns here. It looks like it could be possible under some circumstances, but I'm not convinced that that's really the primary route that the problem's going to arise. I still think it's going to be primarily through you just breeding resistant bugs in your own body, or if you're administering the drugs to farm animals, again, the same kind of thing happening with them, where they might be infected with some sort of pathogenic E. coli, and now that pathogenic E. coli is learning to be resistant to the drugs you're feeding the cow. Beyond that, it's hard, and I could only speculate.
Okay, any more questions on the phone? We have a couple minutes more. Okay, there was one other question that came up from the web that I'm not sure that Mitch would want to answer particularly, but it's more of a policy question. It's, what kind of time frame is the EPA looking at to more clearly define which contaminants will be regulated? And I think we can answer that by saying that we are at the beginning of gathering data and trying to understand the exposures and the effects and that type of thing about some of these drugs. And I'm not really sure we can tell you right now that we have a specific time frame. So with that, I will go ahead and close this particular question and answer session. And I'd like to thank Mitch again for his presentation. And then I'd also like to remind you that there is an online feedback form to help us improve our webinar, so don't want you to forget that. Also, if you haven't checked in yet, there's a web page that you can do that on, particularly for those on the phone. If you would take a minute to do so before you leave the webinar, we would appreciate that a great deal. Then with that, we'll go ahead and also, one other thing I wanted to just mention for you. And audio will be archived for future viewing with a standard media player, and you can look at that and catch it. Somebody's not on mute. Star 6, thank you. And you can catch it about a week or so from now. Now, to go to the next talk, go ahead and go back to
second talk is Susan Glassmeyer. She is also from our Office of Research and Development, and she will be speaking on identifying chemical compounds from wastewater disposal. And then, again, there's a little reminder that we do ad nauseum on these webinars is please stay on mute, star 6, and please don't put us on hold. And with that, I'll turn it over to Susan.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Susan Glassmeyer. I am starting on slide 28 of the presentation package. And just to highlight my other co-authors on this work, Dana Colpin and Edward Furlong, they are both researchers with the U.S. Geological Survey, and you may be familiar with their names. In 2002, Dana published, or was the first author, on one of the first occurrence papers in the United States. And if you haven't seen that, it was published in Environmental Science and Technology. I encourage you to go to your library and look that up. It's a really informative first look at pharmaceuticals in the United States. So if you go to slide 29, I have an overview of what I'll be discussing today. Basically, I'll be talking about two different research projects I've been looking at. The first is the effects of chlorination on different pharmaceuticals in laboratory studies. And then second will be the work that I participate in with Ed and Dana, looking in the field at the concentration of these chemicals downstream of wastewater treatment plants, or WWTPs. And then as the final, I'll be trying to see if there's any ways that can tie together these two different research projects and see if there's a correlation between what the lab predicted and what we observed in the environment. So you turn to slide 30. This is the first work that kind of got me thinking about pharmaceuticals. This is something that Thomas Turner published in 1998. And it shows the elimination of a variety of pharmaceuticals during sewage treatment. And you can see some of the compounds that are eliminated quite well, up into 90%, but others are in the low 30%. So, if you turn to slide 31, someone on the last webinar had questions about what are the resources that are out there looking at these chemicals in wastewater treatment. So this is just a handful of different citations from the past 2 years that you may want to look up if you are very interested in looking at wastewater treatment removal of these compounds. So, what is going on with wastewater treatment? As you can see in slide 32, the raw sewage comes in, and there's a variety of screening mechanisms to get rid of large chunks, not to be gross, but large materials, branches, other things that may fall into the waste. Then it goes to a clarifying step, where a lot of the solids are separated out into sludge or biosolids, depending on how you want to call them. The samples are then go to secondary treatment where it gets a biological digestion in the aeration tank, that area, and the activated sludge steps. Those are both biological digestion. And then there's disinfection at the end. In the United States, this disinfection is typically chlorine. Something I want to point out is that today I'm only going to be talking about the liquid waste, the compounds that are chlorinated and discharged into surface water. But the sludge is something that we need to think about, too. In surface waters, concentrations are typically in the high nanograms per liter to low micrograms per liter. That's a part per trillion to part per billion. In sludges, they're normally in milligrams per kilograms. That's a part per million. So they're typically 1,000 times higher concentration in the sludges than they are in the surface water effluents. And Chad Kinney of the USGS just published a paper. I don't even know if it's officially completely out yet. It's in Environmental Science and Technology. It is available on the web now, where he was looking at these compounds in sludges. So that might be something, too, if you're interested in, to look up. Oops, and I hit the wrong button. Okay. So on slide 33, we want to look what is going on with these pharmaceuticals during sewage treatment. Well, there's five different things I came up with that could be happening. One, as I just mentioned, they could be sorbed to particulate matter and removed as sludge. And as I said, this could be a pretty significant way of removal from this from the effluent. They could be chlorinated during the disinfection process, forming a new compound. They could be destroyed by oxidation during the disinfection process as well. So this would be a very small organic molecule that would be formed, quite different from the parent product. We could also be going to undergo some type of degradation not related to disinfection, so either microbial disinfection or degradation or catalysis, as Mitch had mentioned earlier, just some other process that we're still breaking the compound down into something that's not the parent product. And, of course, as step five says, nothing could be happening to them. They could just be passing through the system completely unchanged. So if you turn to slide 34, this is just a graphical representation of the laboratory research project that I did. I took two samples, and then one of them was chlorinated, one was not chlorinated. The non-chlorinated sample I analyzed immediately, and then I let both samples wait on the benchtop for 48 hours. At that point, I reanalyzed the two samples. This way I can make sure that there was no changes in the unchlorinated sample that were unattributable to chlorination. I could also then see what different products were formed as a result of chlorination. And for this, I used a particle beam mass spectrometry technique. The particle beam is one of the more rare type of liquid chromatography mass spectrometry system. One of the advantages of it is that it produces a complete EI, or electron impact spectra. This is very handy because it allows you to get better information on what the structure of the compound is, and also you're able to use conventional libraries. There's a NIST library, there's a Wiley library out there that has just for thousands of different chemicals, it has what mass spectra you're supposed to be, what should show up. And these are used for UGC normally, but not for electrospray liquid chromatography mass spectrometry. So with this particle beam liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, you're able to use these spectral libraries. But there is a problem with the particle beam that the solvent has a pretty bad interference. So you can't see anything much below 100. And it's also difficult to see higher masses, anything about above 700 daltons. So you're really in a very small window of visualization. And also the calibration curves are neither linear nor stable. So quantitation is very difficult on this instrument system. As well, there's poor sensitivity. So these samples I had to make up in milligrams per liter solutions, which are, as I mentioned, about 1,000 times more concentrated than what's in the environment. But as this is just a laboratory study of just trying to see what was going on grossly, I thought it'd be okay. So you turn to slide 36. Some of you may not be familiar with what a chromatogram and mass spectra looks like. So I've just labeled them here. You can see chromatogram are basically the peak type items on the center portion of the slide. And if you looked at the peak of the chromatogram, you get the mass spectra that's pictured on the upper right-hand corner. So this is caffeine. You can see its molecular weight is 194, and at 194, you do get a nice peak. That's the molecular ion. Now, if you go to slide 37, I have both the non-chlorinated and the chlorinated spectra and chromatogram shown, and I'm going to be doing this for several different compounds. But you can see there is no real change in the retention time of the peak, between the chromatogram of the non-chlorinated and the chlorinated samples, and there is no change in the mass spectra. Now, if you go to slide 38, I have acetaminophen. And you can see at the top, the chromatogram for acetaminophen has only one peak, and its mass spectra, which is the top spectra on the right-hand side, you see peaks at 109 and 151, which agree well with the molecular weight, also at 151. If you go down to the bottom part of the slide, you can see the chlorinated chromatogram. And you see two additional peaks form that I've labeled 1 and 2. And on the right, you can see the two different spectra that come out of this. Now, if you turn to slide 39, I kind of go into mass spectrometry 101. Chlorine exists in two different isotopic abundances. It's Cl35 and Cl37. And they're in approximately a 3-to-1 ratio. So you have a compound with one chlorine on it. It can either be, it'll be 3/4 of the time, it'll be in a Cl35. 1/4 of the time, it'll be a Cl37. So you get this very, very fingerprint that's distinctive for different chlorinated compounds. So you get a 3-to-1 ratio with one chlorine. And then we have two chlorines. They can either be both Cl35s. One can be a 35, one can be a 37, or both 37s. So that's why you get the more varied fingerprint as you go up in chlorination number. So if you turn to slide 40, I've reprinted the three different spectra that we saw for acetaminophen. The top was the first one that was not chlorinated. The second one, you can see the peak around 177, how that mimics the pattern for a doubly chlorinated compound. And in the bottom, you can see the peaks at 143 mimic that of a singly chlorinated compound. And if you turn to slide 41, I've gone through and shown the transitions a little more clearly. So you can see the peak at 177, that if you took the peak at 109, you add on two chlorines, you take up two hydrogens, you expect to shift to 68 Nash units. And indeed, you go from 109 to 177, that's 68 Nash units. And you can see it, again, with the peaks at 151 transforming up to 219. That's another change of 68 Nash units. If you get down to the bottom spectra, where you're going from 109 to 143, you're adding on one chlorine, taking off a hydrogen, so you're expecting a change of 34. And indeed, 109 plus 34 is 143, and 151 plus 34 is the 185. So that worked out really well. But unfortunately, if you go to slide 42, we don't always get a transition that's that nice. This is diltiazem. You can see that on the top, the non-chlorinated, had a peak at roughly 21 minutes for its chromatogram. But when it was chlorinated, several other peaks were formed down around 7 to 8 minutes. If both those peaks had the same mass spectra, but it was not a direct chlorination or any type of easily identifiable change from the parent product. So this is a case where it was oxidized, but not chlorinated. So if you turn to slide 43, I have a data summary. Many of the compounds I looked at showed no change. Some of the common ones are caffeine, cotinine, which is a nicotine metabolite. 1,7-dimethylxanthine is a caffeine metabolite. So these compounds were not changed by the chlorination. Only two compounds showed a direct chlorination, the acetaminophens I showed you and dimethylbenzil. And then there's a whole handful of other compounds that showed oxidation during the chlorination experiments. So they were broken down to something else that the parent products weren't there, but I wasn't able to identify directly what happened to the products. So if you turn to slide 44, I have some of the lessons learned from this part of the story. Was that disinfection is one route of removal for pharmaceuticals from the water. This chlorination does affect the different compounds. But it looks like that direct chlorination is not a very easy thing to do, and it's not very common. And the third bullet, the ramification of environmental currents, we'll get back to that in a minute. If you want to read a little more about this, I've published one paper on this. And also Mary Bedner just published something in ES&T that you might be interested in reading. And if you need a copy of my paper, feel free to drop me an email and I'll send out a reprint. So, if we turn to slide 45, we want to go into the deeper research application. And so, what I wanted to look at is, can these pharmaceuticals and other wastewater compounds be used as indicators of human contamination? If you turn to slide 46, you can see there's many different sources of fecal pollution into the environment, from humans, from domestic wildlife, from non-domestic wildlife, just a variety of sources. And these compounds, or these waste sources, make in the surface water, and eventually it can make into drinking water. Currently, if you turn to slide 47, we use microbial indicators to determine where fecal material is, such as beaches or in drinking water, those type of things. But the problem with these, there's several. The first is that these biological assays require at least 24 hours for the test to happen. So if you're talking about recreational water, when they get the test back, they find out how the water quality was yesterday. And then you'll find out tomorrow how the water quality was today and if people should be able to swim today. So you can see this 24-hour time lag, there's people being exposed to potentially pathogens at a time that we can't tell that they're being exposed, and we won't know until tomorrow if they were exposed. This is definitely a problem. These tests also lack specificity. If you look at Enterococci or E. coli, you can't tell if it's from a human source or from an animal source. And this can have differences in just in terms of remediation. If you want to know if it's a cattle pasture causing the high levels of bacteria at your beach, or if it's a leaking municipal wastewater treatment plant, you really can't use the traditional methods of looking for E. coli and Enterococci to tell you that. Additionally, there's been some new research looking at fecal versus non-fecal, that a lot of times E. coli and Enterococci, it could be resuspended up from sediments and soils. So you're not necessarily getting a new input, it's just a resuspension of the different compounds or the different bacteria that's already there. And also, these tests haven't always been effective against pathogens. At the large crypto outbreak in Wisconsin, for example, that was 5-10 years ago now, that the water quality standards were being met at that time, but it wasn't being protective enough against crypto. So all these show some of the weakness of the current indicators. So why should we use the chemical indicators on slide 48? Well, one of the best advantages is rapid analysis time. Instead of 24 hours, these samples, you can go from a water sample to a number in 4 to 8 hours. So that's much quicker. You're also able to discriminate between human sources and animal sources. You know, cows don't drink coffee. So we can use things such as caffeine as one way of discriminating between human sources and animal sources. Also, by looking at a suite of different compounds with different properties, we can look at a wide variety of waters, you know, from waters that are very, very high in TOC. We can have compounds that won't settle out as easily as some others. Look at waters at different temperatures, look at waters at different sources. So if we're looking for a suite of a large number of compounds, we have a better chance of finding a magic bullet than just looking at one or two at a time. But there is what I like to call the Goldilocks principle, is that they need to be persistent enough to survive wastewater treatment, but they can't be so stable that they can be ubiquitous in the environment. So at that point, they become meaningless. And this research I'm talking about now has been published in ES&T this past year. If you'd like, I can send you a reprint of this. Feel free to contact me. So turning to slide 49, this is a sampling scheme that we used. At the 10 orangey-yellowish dots, those are the different wastewater treatment plants that we sampled from around the country. At these sites, we took one upstream sample, we took an effluent sample, and we took two samples downstream. With this, we hope to get what's kind of persistent in the environment, what this each of the individual plants are releasing into the environment, and get an idea of the persistence downstream, at the two downstream samples. We also took two background location samples that are indicated by the blue dots. The one in Montana was located on a CAFO, so it's highly cow-dominated with very little human input, just to see what chemicals we found there. The other one in northern Michigan was what we call the pristine site. It had very little human impact at all. So you turn to slide 50. This is the experimental approach we used for these samples. We looked at the traditional microbial indicators, E. coli and Enterococci, using the standard EPA method. I think it's part of EPA method 1600. It's a filtration and enumeration method. For chemicals, we looked for 110 different chemicals using three different methods. One method was for pharmaceuticals, included, I think, 26 compounds. For that, we used liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry with electrospray. We also had a method for 23 different antibiotics. That included human and veterinary antibiotics. That also was analyzed using LC-MS. And then there are 65 compounds, I believe, that were wastewater-dominated compounds that included pharmaceuticals, surfactants, flame retardants, this wide variety of different compounds. And those were analyzed using GC-MS. So if you turn to slide 51, this is a quick overview of the results, and I'll go into more detail on some of the compounds in a second. So you can see the bacterial concentrations tend to be lower in the wastewater treatment plant effluent than in the either the upstream or the downstream samples. And this, at first, I thought I was doing things wrong. I'm not a microbiologist by training, and so I was running these samples in the effluent, which I expected to be the highest. We actually had some had no counts whatsoever. So I was a little worried that I screwed things up. Then I thought about it a minute that there's probably a residual amount of the disinfectant in these samples, which effectively killed them in the samples, where it's downstream. They're either able to grow in more or just be washed off from the surrounding areas. And bacteria were detected at both of the reference locations. And at Montana, we actually had a number that exceeded the one sample recreational water guidelines. So this is kind of a prime example of the fact that these indicators don't protect from human waste, which presumably has human pathogens. If we want to turn to the chemical analyses, as I mentioned, we looked for 110 different chemicals by these three methods, and 78 of these chemicals were found in at least one sample. And six were found in at least 75% of the samples. Fourth bullet on that section, the median number of compounds by sample type. You can see upstream we had 10 compounds, and the effluent that increased to 35, and you see downstream samples, that number decreased to 32 and then 24. And we had very few hits of these compounds at the reference locations. We only had three compounds detected with a total concentration, if you can see, of 0.03 of a microgram per liter, and that was only at the Michigan site. We had no detects at the Montana site, showing how they are a little bit more discriminatory than the bacterial indicators are. So if you turn to slide 52, this is a representation of the frequency of detection by use classification. And along the x-axis, I have the different chemical groupings, and the number of parentheses are the number of compounds within each class. So you can see the third bar in are the non-prescription drugs. They're at about 40%. So those nine compounds were detected about 40% of the time. The next bar over, which is the fourth bar with prescription drugs, they're slightly less frequently detected, but that could be a function of the fact that there's fewer in use. They're not as easily obtainable as non-prescription drugs. I also want to point out that we did segregate the antibiotics from the prescription drugs, and the antibiotics are actually the last bar from the right. Part of the reason why we did that is that so many of the antibiotics were veterinary compounds that it skewed the results low, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, they were detected less than 10% of the time. So turning to slide 53. Just want to orient you a minute to what this is. Along the x-axis, we have the changes between different compartments. So the first one is between the upstream sample and the wastewater treatment plant. Then we have between the upstream sample and the downstream, the first downstream sample. The third grouping is between the upstream and the second downstream. And we go to the wastewater treatment plant to the downstreams, and then between the downstreams to each other. The purplish bar is the number of compounds. The orange bar is the total concentration. So you can see between the upstream and the wastewater treatment plant, the first set of bars, that there is a statistically significant difference between both the number of compounds and the total concentration found. This makes sense. You know, you're getting the influence of the waste at the effluent sample, the WTP sample. So you're seeing both a dramatic increase in terms of the compounds and the concentration. Now, between the second set of bars, the upstream and the first downstream sample, you begin to see the effects of dilution and other remediation, or not remediation, but removal steps, so that while there is still a significant difference between the upstream and the first downstream sample in terms of concentration and number of compounds, that it's not as great as it was to the direct effluent sample. And you can see that it becomes even less in between the upstream sample and the second downstream sample, that there is only a significant difference in the number of compounds between those two samples. Now, if you turn to the wastewater samples, the second or last three bars, you can see that we're showing a negative percent change. So, right, that's showing that there's a loss between the number of compounds in the wastewater treatment sample and the downstream samples. And that by the time the waste traveled to the second downstream sample, that difference became significant. And between the two different downstream samples, there really wasn't a significant change in either the number of compounds or the difference, or the total concentration. So if you turn to slide 54, I swear this isn't an eye test. What we're trying to do here, we're looking at the 35 most frequently detected compounds. Cotinine was most frequently detected at something around 80%. Dichlorobenzene was, of this grouping, the least frequently detected. I believe it was something around 50%. Basically, I just need to condense my data set from 110 down to 35 to something a little more manageable to do some more statistical analyses on. The compounds in orange are the different pharmaceuticals in this grouping, and for our uses, we call caffeine a pharmaceutical, as well as 1,7-dimethylxanthine, which is the caffeine metabolite. And you see quite a few pharmaceuticals are in this grouping, as well as other industrial compounds. So if you turn to slide 55, you can't probably read the x-axis on this very well, and that's okay. We'll be getting to a little closer up for some of the compounds in a minute. I just wanted you to be able to see just some of the range of the different chemicals. This bar, this graph's also a little hard to understand. So the orange bar at the bottom, that is the frequency detection in the upstream samples. The light green bar is the effluent. The dark green is the first downstream, and the light blue is the second downstream. And so if this is an additive, cumulative frequency detection on the y-axis. So pretty much if something was detected 100% in every compartment, you just expect to see a bar, all four bars added together, be at 400%. So you can see some chemicals have, in the upstream sample, the orange bar, is nearly at 100%. So these compounds are very, very ubiquitous in the environment, that they tend to even be in the upstream samples. But you can see for most of the bars, there's an increase between the orange bar and the light green bar, showing the input from the wastewater treatment plant. And then for the chemicals, the dark green bar and light blue bar are very different. So some of them, the light green bar and the dark green bar are almost at 100%, showing that they're pretty stable in the environment, whereas others, I mean, some don't even have a light green bar present, or excuse me, they don't have a light blue bar present, indicating that they're very transitory in the environment. They don't last that long. They're not even there at the second downstream sample. So if you turn to slide 56, this is the blow-up I was promising you of, just so we can look at some chemicals more in detail. So the first two bars are the E. coli and arcoxide. You can see in terms of frequency detection, they are nearly at 100% at every sample. So they're very, very frequent in the environmental samples as well as in the effluent. If you look at acetaminophen and DEET, DEET is the insecticide people use commonly in sprays. as well as Honolid, you can see how they are relatively low in the upstream samples, and then you get a pulse of them in the effluent, the light green bar, and their amounts in the two downstream samples, the dark green bar and light blue bar, are different. You also see, say, compare acetaminophen and cholesterol, you see a difference in the size of the light blue bar showing their difference in their environmental persistence. So if you turn to slide 57, I've turned the occurrence data kind of on its head. So instead of being one bar stacked, we're now four bars grouped together, but still the same color coding, with the orange being the upstream, the light green being the effluent, dark green being the first downstream, and the light blue being the second downstream. On top of this, I have superimposed the median concentrations. So you can see for the E. coli and enterococci, when I mentioned earlier that there was a decrease in concentration in the effluent, you can see how the sample dots go high and then low in the effluent samples superimposed on the light green bars for those two bacteria. For the chemicals, you can see their increase in the wastewater treatment. So for something like cholesterol, there's a very, very significant increase, as you can tell, when it's going from the upstream sample into the effluent into the two downstreams. And you can also see how the change downstreams are different for the different chemicals. So if you look at DEET, DEET is very stable, or fairly stable. It shows an increase in the effluent, and then only slight decreases as it goes downstream. But if you look at Tonalid, right next to it, you see a drastic increase as well as a drastic decrease downstream, showing that these two compounds have different environmental persistences. So if we turn to slide 58, this is another one of my fun many-colored slides. But I've separated the compounds by their different concentration and their persistence in the water. So if you look at the first column on the left, the compounds such as dimethylxanthine, acetaminophen, caffeine, cotinine, and the phenol, these compounds are ones that are very persistent in the environment, and there is no statistical difference in the concentration in any of the different sample groups. If you go the opposite of this, if you go to the compounds in orange, which are on the far right, the ethyl citrates, the galaxolid, the tonalid, these compounds show the difference in concentrations between the upstream wastewater treatment plant, between the wastewater treatment plant and the first downstream, as well as between the wastewater treatment plant and the second downstream. So these compounds are very short-lived in the environment. Now I kind of made up different classifications. So the ones in black, I call those ubiquitous. You know, those were found pretty much everywhere. There's no statistical difference. If you look at the compounds in purple, the carbamazepine, the codeine, those compounds we call the calcitrants. They're not very common upstream, so you're seeing the input in terms of the difference between the upstream sample and the wastewater treatment plant sample. You see a significant increase there, but you're not seeing any significant difference between the wastewater treatment plant sample and a downstream sample. So these compounds are very, very persistent in the environment. As a DEET is one of these compounds, and if you remember back on the slide previous to this, you can see how the concentration did not change. The compounds in blue and green are kind of between the purples and the orange, so they're more moderate. They do show some difference between the wastewater treatment plant and the downstream samples, so they're, they're intermediate, so they're not short-lived and not long-lived. So if we want to go to the next slide, which is slide 59, what's some of the lessons we learned from this? Well, we saw definitely these compounds survive wastewater treatment. We are finding them in effluent, we're finding them downstream. But that the upstream background levels of some of these compounds are low, so they indicate they're not too ubiquitous, except for that handful that I showed you in the black column of the previous slide. The downstream samples decrease at different rates for the different chemicals, as you can see by the difference in persistence. The slide, two slides back with the different dots, you can see how they do decrease at different rates. So from this, we decided that we think these can be utilized as chemical indicators of fecal contamination. And we're doing some more work on this net, and I'll be talking about that in future work. So, we have these two different projects. We have one that's a laboratory-based project. We have one that's a field study. So how can we combine what the results from both of these? Well, there are 9 chemicals that were analyzed in both studies. So we want to see if there's a difference in the frequency detection and median concentration of these based on the chlorination. So if you turn to slide 61, so you can see the 9 different compounds that were in both studies. The first 3 were ones that did not show any change based on chlorination. The middle 2 were the 2 that were chlorinated, and the bottom were the ones that were oxidized. And for this to have the frequency of detection and median concentration. And when I first looked at this, I'm like, well, crud, that doesn't really prove what I wanted to prove. But then I remembered that in the study, not all the wastewater treatment plant effluents were chlorinated. There were, I think, 4 plants that used UV instead. So if you turn to slide 62, I've separated out the samples that only use chlorine. So you can see, say, caffeine, which was one of the compounds that we showed was not chlorinated, had a concentration, a median concentration of 0.05 micrograms per liter when you looked at all the data. But if you only look at the sites that use chlorine, the concentration is 0.17 micrograms per liter, indicating, showing that it was not affected by the chlorine, and that, you know, follows too with the other 2 compounds that did not show effects from chlorination. Now, if you look at acetaminophen, that was the compound that was chlorinated. And if you're only looking at the chlorinated site, the concentration did increase from 0.006 micrograms per liter to 0.02 micrograms per liter. But if you remember back on the slide that showed the acetaminophen chlorination, part of that parent product did go through wastewater treatment or through the chlorination bottle studies unchlorinated. And the fact that acetaminophen is an over-the-counter drug, is probably used very high concentrations, it makes sense that we are seeing that little bit of the non-chlorinated stuff still in effluents. And the compounds that are oxidized at the bottom, you can see their concentrations are still all very low. And in fact, the warfarin was not detected. So if you turn to slide 63, I further broke this down, looking at, again, just the chlorinated sites versus the UV-treated sites. And again, you can see, especially for the caffeine, the cotinine, and the 1,7-dimethylxanthine, distinct difference between the chlorination as a disinfectant versus UV as disinfectant. These first 3 compounds were not affected by chlorine, and so they're shown more commonly in the chlorinated effluent than in the UV effluent, so they probably were affected by the UV. And again, so you see that with the acetaminophen. Conversely, you see slightly larger concentrations and detections, especially with cimetidine for the oxidative compounds. So cimetidine was affected by the chlorine, but not as much by the UV disinfection. And right now I'm currently working on a little more analysis of this because in addition to the different disinfectant techniques, there was differences in the secondary treatment, the secondary biological treatment. Some of the sites use a trickling filter, others use activated sludge. So I'm in the process of doing this type of analysis based on secondary treatment as well. And I'll be reporting on this at CTAC next month. In addition, we hope to have this published sometime next year. So if you're interested in that, just give me a line, and I'll try to keep you informed on the progress as that goes. So if you turn to slide 64, this was the slide I presented earlier showing the 35 most frequently detected compounds, just to kind of remind you of what we saw and how frequently we saw them. But then if you turn to slide 65, these shows you the compounds that were higher in the chlorinated effluents. So the ones in black were the ones that were shown to be, that had higher concentrations, like the caffeine, in the chlorinated effluents. Only one compound, the diazinon, that was higher in the UV-treated effluents versus the chlorinated effluents. And the compounds in light blue really showed no trend between one disinfectant or the other, they're probably treated or were affected equally by either disinfectant. So, turn to slide 66, what we learned from this is that the chemical removal is dependent on the different technologies in the plant, and that if, obviously if it's less removed, that there's a greater potential for these compounds to be in the environment. And as I mentioned, we're still considering the secondary treatments before we really finalize the conclusions of this part of the paper. So what am I going to be doing next? We have three different projects we're working on. The first are the orange dots, the Lagrangian samples. So we went to two locations in Iowa and Colorado, and we performed dye tracers tests. And in the lower left-hand of the slide, you can see the different pictures from the dye tracer as it's just coming into view, as it's right at the sample site, and as it's dissipating. And what we want to do with this, we used the dye tracers the day before we sampled. So that way we can get a time of travel to different sampling locations. That way we can ensure the next day we're sampling the same parcel of water, and with this we can do some pseudo first order rate constants to kind of get their, better quantify their environmental persistence to these different chemicals. We're also participating in some recreational or epidemiological studies, and those are indicated by the blue dots on the Great Lakes, and we just had our one beach down on the Gulf Coast in Biloxi. And with this, this is really proving the proof of the pudding of the chemical indicators. These are part of the NEAR recreational water study. They're going out on weekends, interviewing bathers to see how long they've been in the water, where they were in the water, if they put their head under water, that type of thing, and ask them if they had any symptoms of either earaches, gastrointestinal distress, those type of things, to contact the researchers. So we can see there's a correlation between the concentrations and presence of these chemicals and negative health impacts experienced by the bathers due to pathogens in the water. So we're not looking for relationships between diseases caused by these chemicals being there, but more the pathogens that are there, more acute effects. So that we're doing our last speech this summer. I'm still going to court, or the summer 07 will be the sixth speech. And we hope to be wrapping up that part of our project. The newest work that we're just starting this year is looking at drinking water. So we're hoping to go to 9 to 15 different drinking water treatment plants that are pretty heavily impacted by wastewater, either downstream from an effluent, using some type of indirect to direct water reuse, those type of situations, and analyze the samples, both a raw surface water and the finished drinking water, to see what the removal within drinking water treatment is and what kind of products are being formed due by the disinfectant. So we're looking for some of the chlorinated byproducts as well in this part of the experiment. And for this, we still haven't completely finalized all of our different sites. So if anyone is either a drinking water treatment plant operator, or if you are part of a municipality that you think would like to participate, I'd love to hear from you. Please give me a call or drop me an email. I'd appreciate it. So if we go to slide 68, these are just some of the USGS field personnel that were involved in actually collecting the samples. Without their help, we would not have been able to do the study. And on slide 69 is my contact information. So as I said, please feel free to drop me an email or give me a call about anything that I've presented in this work. And I want to thank you for your attention. So I'll turn things back over to Jan for the question and answer.
Okay, Susan, thank you very much. And we'll go ahead again and start our second question and answer session. It'll be the same type of pattern as we did before. Just a little reminder, if you will, about checking in if you have the time before you leave the webinar. And with that, we'll go ahead and go with our first question from our web. And this one is from the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, Pixie Wetmore. Is anyone performing parallel research for wastewater treatment plants that use UV disinfection, Susan? And I know you talked a little bit about your four that you included in yours, but perhaps you can elaborate a little further on any studies that you know that have focused on that and maybe give people a sense of how many of the plants that you're doing in your upcoming research will be UV versus chlorination?
Those are very good questions. As I mentioned in our study, we did have, I think, three of the plants who used UV. And as I said, in this upcoming work, I'll be doing the dissemination between the two different disinfectants and elucidate some of the results from that a little more clearly. As far as other literature things, I know there have been other ones. I don't want to talk off the top of my head completely, but a lot of the studies in Europe, they use either UV or ozone as their disinfectant. So there are quite a few resources out there. That's something that I could probably provide a better answer on in the upcoming materials. So as Mitch was going to do with one of his, I'll provide a much clearer and more concise list of studies that reflect just UV samples.
Okay. Anybody on the phone that would like to ask a question? Okay, I'd like to jump in. This is Dottie from Region 9. Susan, the chemical analytical methods that you used, the LCMS, that's fabulous. One of the things that I hear is the concern that there aren't chemical standards for helping direct various monitoring programs for either the agencies, the state agencies, or the wastewater treatment plants. First of all, how did you choose the chemicals that you did? Was that one of your bases for your criteria? And how can you help us target those ones that are, or should we be targeting maybe some of the other ones where standards aren't available?
Good question. As far as the work I've done with the USGS, those compounds were methods that they developed. Pretty much Ed looked at the Rx.com list in 1998, I believe, when he first started developing this method, and was looking for the most common compounds. When I was doing the bottle studies, I used a similar type of selection process, looking again for the more commonly prescribed or the more commonly used compounds. But one of the problems that I did run into is that some of the chemicals, especially the narcotics, you need to have DEA clearance for. And that was not something I decided to try to get for myself. But definitely having standards is something that you really need to do in order to find, to be very sure that you have the right compound. There is, with your chromatography and using mass spectrometry, you can be fairly certain of what compound you have, but there's always isomers and this type of thing. So, or just with one of the problems with traditional electric spray mass spectrometry as well is that you only get you get few ions to use as a characterization. So that's one of the reasons why I was using particle beam from the other side of experiments, was because I got a better spectra and could better identify and verify what my compounds were. So as far as what to look for, I mean, I'd suggest looking at the compounds. Mitch is suggesting, you know, that's a great list to start. And as far as standards, Sigma-Aldrich, not to specify any trade vendors, that type of thing, but you can find a lot of these commercially available.
Thank you. Okay, let's go ahead and take one off of the web. Can you talk about the typical cost and availability of analyses for pharmaceuticals at a lab?
That really just depends on where you're going for and what you want and how many compounds. I can tell you basically somewhere between $300 and $500 per sample is common for a mass spectrometry-based method. It depends too on what matrix you're looking at. If you're looking at drinking water versus surface water versus treated wastewater effluent versus raw sewage, you know, all those are going to be different costs because there's different cleanup steps involved. All of our methods, we did a filtration step first in order to remove a lot of the particulate matter from the water, and we just analyzed the filtered water samples. So the filtration, that's another analytical cost. could be $50 for the filtration step. So it really depends, somewhere between probably $350 to $300, probably to $700 maybe per sample.
Thank you. Anyone on the phone with a question? Okay, here's one from our web. It says, thanks for a very persuasive presentation and demonstration of alternative choices to current EPA standard methods for indications of fecal pollution. And now asking for comments on as important and useful as fecal sterols and chlorinated flame retardants are, there is still a need to optimize the methods for pathogens to be truly informed of their environmental distribution and risk planning. And that was asking for comments, Susan.
Oh, that is definitely true, and that's something my division here in Cincinnati is also working on. The near beach study that I participated in, the actual mission of that is to test newer microbial methods using qPCR and other quicker techniques, as well as looking for a variety of different bacteria in addition to the E. coli enterococci. So the agency, or at least my group, is cognizant of the problems and are trying to work on different microbial-based techniques as well. I just thought, as a chemist, I can assist their work by looking at these chemicals. And it might be something, too, that we can use in tandem to look for both chemicals and microbials at the same time, so that way we get some type of source discrimination information from the samples. So, yes, the bacteria are not dead. They're still doing a lot of work on those. And Rich Hoagland, he's one of the people here, and Chris Brenner, they're two of the scientists that have been involved in making these methods better, so you can just look for literature on their names, or if you want to contact me with a question, I can forward it on to them if you have something on the different microbial methods.
Great. Anyone on the phone ready for a question? Phone guys are falling behind. We've got another one from the web now. What are the common names for cotinine and diltiazem? And where were the four streams used in the study? And if you know, what are the names of the stream? This is from Mike McKee of Missouri Department of Conservation.
Okay, cotinine is a nicotine metabolite. So it's just a byproduct form in humans and passed out of humans. That's a really good tracer of a product that has been gone through human ingestion. Diltiazem, I'm blanking on its use. I want to say it is blood pressure. Okay, Mitch, just help me out for a second. It's a blood pressure medication. So I don't know what some of the common products is in. The four streams, actually there were 10 streams that we looked at. They're in the map on slide. Let's see, what slide was that? Slide 49 had the different streams you investigated. We didn't really want to identify which streams and what they were exactly, so we didn't incriminate any specific wastewater treatment plant. There is some information in the paper about the size of the plant that you might, and the population served, that you might be able to guess what streams they are and where, but I don't want to comment any further than that.
Okay, any questions from the phone? Okay, another one from the web. What, if anything, did your study show about the potential use of analysis for pharmaceuticals as a quicker way of detecting human fecal contamination than traditional and slower culture methods?
That's something we're still working out with the epidemiological studies. The epidemiologist statistician is still looking at the concentration data that I generated versus the health effects data that was collected at the beaches. And they're trying to see if there's a correlation. So right now, I'll probably have a better answer to that in 6 to 9 months when that analysis is done. There definitely, the detects at the beaches were much lower in terms of frequency and concentration than in the streams directly downstream of wastewater treatment plants, which is to be expected. But we still need to see if there's a link between the ebb and flow of the concentrations versus the illnesses experienced at these beaches. So I'll let you know on that as it comes out.
Okay, any questions from the phone? Okay, we have another one. Please consider our wastewater treatment facility in Fountain Valley, California for your study. We are anticipating that we will transfer 70, I think it's million gallons per day to our neighboring water processing facility beginning in the middle of 2007 for use in the drinking water system. Perhaps this would serve your study needs. Do you have
yes.
a volunteer? This is Thomas Zarwatsky in the Orange County Sanitation District.
That sounds really great. And Thomas, you can send me an email with your contact information. Oh, I see your email address is there. So, yeah, that sounds perfectly like the type of site we're looking for. So if anyone else is out there in Radio Land, please let me know because I need to get this done. I want to try to get the site finalized by the beginning of the new year. So right now we're still open. And it's a way to get a free analysis for you. Nothing else.
Okay, any questions from the phone?
Okay, it's Bobby again. I'd like to ask, and perhaps you've already answered it. I know that from listening to folks at the, I believe, FDA, that there's a categorical exclusion for drugs if it's calculated that their concentration in the waters of the world, I think is my understanding, is less than a part per billion. Are any of the ones of the drugs that you were analyzing for among that group, or were you really targeting the ones where there were high concentrations or high levels of expected high concentrations in water?
We really didn't, in terms of what chemicals we were looking for, didn't, as far as I know, Ed did look at the FDA categorical exclusion list. As far as compounds above, what was it, one part per billion, we did have some detects. Caffeine, I know, was sometimes at 6-7 parts per billion. Some of the surfactants, those type of things, were up to 20-30 parts per billion. So we did see concentrations in excess of that value. And there's probably a part of that question that I didn't quite process. So.
Oh, no, it was just, it was around whether or not there was an intersection of the kinds of your target chemical list with those that might have had an exclusion, but I think that you were probably just targeting two different kinds of lists, really.
Yeah, Ed, when he was first developing this list, was just trying to get the best as he could. So, like I said, he used the Rx.com. He looked at other papers that were coming out of Europe to see what kind of compounds they were looking for, and just trying to get an idea of what might be commonly seen in the United States.
Okay, we have another volunteer for you, Susan. It says, please consider our location at the Central Coast of California, Akin Babatola of Santa Cruz.
Great.
Is that another one for you?
Give me more information. I'll consider everything.
Okay. He's given you his email address. You can start a conversation there.
Okay.
Any other questions on the phone?
Hello, this is Angela Primesberger at Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I had a comment and a question. Our agency, when working with USGS, Kathy Lee and Larry Barber did some work at drinking water facilities in 2000 and 2002 and with our health department. And that report is on their website. Might want to take a look at that. And then the other thing I wondered is EPA planning or have RFPs to do any biological assessments related to pharmaceutical effects in the field.
Let me comment on this first, and I'll turn it back to Mitch because he may know a little better. His group does more biological work than mine does. At the two sites that we did Lagrangian studies in Iowa and in Boulder, Colorado, they just did, as well as the chemicals, they did a biodetach. They did different taxa. So they are trying to link the concentrations to health effects to biota in those studies as well. That was a different collaborator from outside the USGS. I believe it's someone at Colorado School of Mines. The paper will come out of his name, I believe. So I don't quite know anything on the status of that, but I know data was done on that. But Mitch, do you know of anything
You know, as far as the kind of newer sorts of biological assays, whether it be cell-based or doing vitellogenin and things like that, we're doing a lot of research on those and potentially using them for pharmaceuticals. But right now, all that stuff is in really early research stages, and we don't really know how to translate the results into, you know, some kind of regulatory tool or anything like that. But one of the probably key places that we find them useful is, like, when we have no idea what the contaminant is and we're trying to track backwards, then those kind of assays are pretty useful. Especially if you don't have to do whole animal exposures because they're so expensive and all that. If you can figure out a cell-based assay and you can find some, for instance, estrogenic activity and work backwards. That's a good research tool. And similarly, when we're dealing with mixtures and trying to figure out what the net effect of a mixture is, then, you know, just the chemistry by itself doesn't tell you enough, and you kind of have to start looking at biological readouts. And some of the newer assays are more convenient, but they don't give you a definitive answer. But still, I would consider them all research tools.
Okay, and this will have to be our last question, and it's from the web. Is anyone working with pharmaceutical companies to perform studies on ecological effects? This is from Mark Latham of the Connecticut DEP.
I turn that one back to Mitch as well.
I think we've been talking about it a little bit, but we don't have anything going as of yet. At least my group doesn't, and I couldn't really speak for the government more broadly, but I haven't heard of anything like that. You know, the FDA encourages them to do for things that don't meet the exception rules for an ecological impact statement. I believe they're under certain circumstances required to do some testing there, but I think it's kind of mostly old style testing. It's not going to typically be the chronic toxicity testing that's going to, you know, it's mostly going to be like kill them and count them type tests.
Okay, I'd like to thank Susan again for the presentation. And I'd like to remind you that today's slides and audio will be archived for future viewing with a standard Windows media player. And I also wanted to tell you briefly, we have two more sessions on this webinar. The next one on October 24th focuses on the research on aquatic toxicity, and this was done by Jeffrey Armstrong of the Sanitation District of Orange County, California, and also by Marcia Black of the University of Georgia in Athens. And this research provided indications of the potential aquatic toxicity of some of the PPCPs. And then our very last session will be on November 8th, and it focuses on stewardship activities, or what we're calling stewardship activities. And for that, Chin Nguyen of EPA will cover a program that EPA has to assist hospitals with their pharmaceutical waste. And Corinne North will provide highlights and lessons learned from a recent San Francisco Bay Area pharmaceutical take-back event. And with that, I'd like to thank Mitch again and you all for coming, and we hope you'll join us for the remaining seminars. Thanks again.
And then we'll turn it over to Jean Valente, who can do a little commercial for our Clue-In site.
Thanks, guys. I wanted to thank everyone again for participating in the seminar today, and just wanted to remind everyone that this is just one of the many features we have available on our Clue-In website. Many of you received communication about this via that, but if you haven't, I would highly encourage that everyone go to www.cluin.org and check out our other training opportunities and other resources that we have available. You can learn more about our events through our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that gets sent out to over 25,000 professionals every month. And you can also sign up for our podcast. If those of you are a little bit iTunes or iPod savvy, you can get an automatic notification when our archive seminars are available for download to replay on your iTunes or iPod or other MP3 player every month. So thanks, everyone, and I encourage and hope that I'll see you all in another seminar in the future.